Hey everyone, welcome to The Business Bug, a pest control podcast where we leave the bugs at the door and instead focus on what drives us forward, the ins and outs of the business of pest control. I'm your host, Adam Weber, former pest control owner and operator, and current CEO of Driven, a pest control performance software. Joining us on today's podcast is Paul Bergman. Paul is the president of Viking Pest Control based in New Jersey. Viking is an anti-CMEX company that services areas in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Maryland. And I am happy to announce that he is also the newest member of Driven's advisory board. Paul, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate you having me. Doing great.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. I'm trying to, for our listeners, they can't see you, but I'm trying to look out your window. You're based in New Jersey, correct?
Correct. We're right in the middle of New Jersey.
Awesome. And I'm out in Utah, so we're basically as far away as we could get from each other. But from what I can recall, Jersey is a cold place as well. Do you guys have snow on the ground? Is it freezing there like it's freezing here?
It's actually pretty nice here today. We're in the mid-50s, but yeah, we do have some harsh winters, although the last 2 years we haven't had any snow, so it can be hit or miss if you're into skiing.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so I'm into skiing, but I also live at the base of like some of the most beautiful mountains in the world. So we are kind of guaranteed great ski weather every winter.
Absolutely. I think you win the competition on best skiing, but we probably win the competition on most number of people in a state. So
yeah, that's fair. So Paul and I were out in Atlantic City together. That was actually my first time to Atlantic City. And I remember hearing everybody say that Atlantic City was the Vegas of the East. And I went into it thinking that. And when I was in the casino, I guess it felt a little bit like that, but it was dead, Paul. I was blown away at how few people there actually were in Atlantic City when we were there.
Yeah, unfortunately, Vegas probably has a leg up on Atlantic City. I don't think it's ever made the recovery that they had hoped for, you know, economically. Probably in your or my lifetime, I don't know that we'll see that again.
Yeah, but cool. So are you from New Jersey originally, or where are you from?
No, I'm not from New Jersey. I was actually born and raised in Baltimore, pretty much all the way up through high school. Went to school in Western Maryland. And then my parents relocated to the South. So I spent some time down in the Carolinas, moved around just due to my career coming right out of college a good bit. But I always wanted to get back to the Northeast. I grew up here, loved it here. There's a lot to do between New York and D.C. So this is really home to me. But I moved a little further north than I had expected. But it's been a great time in New Jersey.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, awesome. Well, Paul, first off, before we jump in, I want to go way back in your history to learn how you kind of came into this space and got involved in pest control. But before we do that, give us just kind of a quick rundown on Viking and the relationship with anti-CMEX and how that has kind of transpired over the last little while.
Yeah, absolutely. So Viking became part of the anti-CMEX family in 2017. The Bradbury family had started Viking back in 1980. So family-owned business, but the largest family-owned business in the New Jersey area. So they had, probably dominated the market. I would be so bold as to say that, but they did a great job. They actually had a lot of small M&A opportunities prior to anti-CMEX, but that helped them grow the business. And kudos to Ed and his sons who grew the business into, what it was at that point in time. And we've just taken it and kind of run with it from there.
Very cool. So 2017 is when that acquisition happened. And you mentioned that they were in the M&A space before, but mainly from an acquiring side, correct? That they were acquiring small companies in the area?
Yeah, absolutely. They had a lot of good relationships with a lot of the small mom and pops. And back then, before M&A was such a hot topic, folks didn't know who to turn to when they were ready to exit the business. So I was looking through some of the files of the business when I came in, and I started looking through these file folders, and they went back for years. And I think I counted more than a dozen small transactions that happened even prior to anti-CMEX coming into the picture.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. So in 2017, when did you say they started the company, Viking?
In 1980.
Okay. So they'd been in business for some time. It's not a Rollins that's been around for 100 years, but it's been in business for a long time. And when you use the word dominated, I feel like people use that a lot to say that they dominate the market. But it sounds like Viking really did that, especially as an acquirer, as people were looking to leave the business. You really only have so many options, and it has to be somebody that's bigger and scaled and has the capacity to really acquire.
Yeah, and dominated is probably a strong word, but leader is certainly a fair word as well. So I think they really led the market. Again, Ed was the guy who started it all, and he was well respected in the business, had a lot of friends. And that's what happens as you continue to grow and you get to know people. And if you have the respect, when it comes time to sell your business, they're going to turn to you and say, "Hey, I'm looking to sell, or I don't have an exit strategy. What can I do?" So I think that was a way that he forged a lot of relationships, over 40 years. So he just did a great job with it. And he's well respected to this day by a lot of people in the community.
Yeah. And is their family still involved in Viking at all post the acquisition?
No, at that point, Ed was, kind of at retirement age. So he did what a lot of folks did and moved south to where it's a little warmer and sunnier.
Smart man.
And he had been going back and forth for years. So I think he's enjoying retirement. Both of his sons have gone into other ventures.
Great. So today's interview is a little bit different because, we've been interviewing a lot of people that are in this small to mid-range size of pest control companies, from I think as small as 4 employees was one of our guests, up to in the 80 to 90 range of one of our guests so far. Whereas Viking is a much bigger organization and much more resources and backing, especially with the Anticimex acquisition and everything that you have. And so there's some really unique pieces that I want to dig into as far as Viking goes. But before we do that, I want to look at your background a little bit. And just so that our listeners can kind of get a feel for who you are and how you've come to be in the position you're at. So maybe just jump back. And you told me this story a little bit when we were in Atlantic City, but tell me a little bit about how you came to be in the pest control industry, the very first chance you had.
Yeah, sure. So my career with pest control began actually coincidentally 20 years ago. So I'm celebrating 20 years this year.
Oh, congrats.
And just by happenstance, I happened to be sitting across the table from the son of somebody that was owned a company, so family-owned business. And we were at a birthday party and he started talking to me about pest control. I had known him from high school, so we hadn't seen each other in probably 10 years at that point. And we were talking and he had a vision for what he wanted to do with his company. So that was American Pest down in the D.C., Virginia, Maryland area.
For clarification, is another Anticimex company now, correct?
Yes. Okay. American is actually the first large platform that was acquired in 2016. So that was Anticimex's entry into the U.S.
Okay. Awesome. Sorry to cut you off. Keep going.
Yeah, no. So we're sitting there, we're having a conversation. He said, "Hey, why don't you come up and hang out for a day and see what pest control is about?" And I was like, "Sure, why not?" So we did. And, fast forward, a few months later, I'm working for a family owned pest control company.
Okay. So what was your first role when you came in to help support him?
So they really didn't have a residential model. They were primarily a government and commercial business, just based on their locale to DC and all the government work that's there. So his vision was to kind of divest in a sense of grow up the residential base of the business. Should they lose a commercial contract or a big government contract, they want to make sure they had something to solidify the business. So I came in, I had one sales guy and one startup tech and one route tech. And we basically built that business up to what is a large portion of that business today. But we really started with almost nothing. It was a really fun journey, great experience. So I guess I was the residential director, but I don't know if we even had a formal title. I kind of started without a title, without a specific job. He just said, "Hey, you got great experience. Let's plug in and see what you can do."
Yeah. So what kind of experience did you have to be able to do that, right? You came into a pest control company. You clearly have no experience at that time in application of pesticides or anything really pest control related. So how do you take that 1-2-man team and turn it into something that's bigger? And obviously that's a big answer, but at least at the start, what were your kind of first steps?
Yeah. So this kind of goes back to, really goes back to college for me. So I was a business administration major. I started working at Lowe's, the home improvement store, while I was in college, just as a way to make money and pay rent and things like that. But that actually turned into my first real career, if you will. So I spent almost 8 years with Lowe's. And when I left there, I was a store manager. So I was running a $50 million store. I had 350 people. So it was a great growing up experience for me as a young guy out of college. And really, that set the foundation for kind of me being a business leader. And I understood a P&L and I understood all the drivers and the metrics behind what big business looks like. So when I told him, I said, "I don't know anything about pest control." His response to me was, "I don't care that you don't know pest control. We can teach you that." He's like, "But what you do know is understanding a P&L and how to run a business and dealing with people." And that was the beginning of my career in pest control.
Love that. I can't count how many times I've used a version of those words. Like, I don't care what you know. I care who you are right now. And if you have the personality and the traits, I can teach the skill set. I can bring those other things to you. But what I can't teach you is how to understand people, how to lead people, how to grow people. Those things are, I feel like, a little bit more innate in some of us.
Yeah. And clearly somebody like Lowe's has a very worked out system where they've, you know, they have a lot of people come in there. They take a lot of young talent and turn them into future leaders for what was a fast growing company. And they're still doing pretty good to this day, to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I have one just down the street from me. So I like that concept of diversifying the revenue. And so I just want to stay there for a second. I may have told this story in other episodes, but I'm like the prime example of not doing that. When I was building my pest control company, we got our first office to just over $1 million in recurring revenue, and we were feeling so great. But we had invested a huge portion of what we were doing in this relationship with a home inspector who was sending us all of these termite inspections, all of this termite work. And overnight, I had an employee quit and start a pest control company with that home inspector and take all of that business. And it ended up being like $250,000 worth of recurring revenue that we had generated. So overnight, we lost a quarter of our business to one relationship that I had invested so much time and money into. And while it was great, I should have been building in fail safes and things like what you're talking about to be able to help support if and when that day happens, and almost just plan for that day to happen instead of just waiting around.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say that, because as soon as I got into pest control, I was looking at the realtor model and could you get in with these realtors or could you get in with these builders? We had more realtor relationships there and I didn't like them. I said, man, I really don't like these realtor relationships. And then we had the housing crunch in 06, 08. And thankfully we did not chase the realtors. But the funny part of that story is we come back to today and we're sitting here brainstorming, trying to figure out how do we generate new leads. And what comes up in the conversation? Well, maybe we should look at the realtor relationships. And I know there's a lot of successful, you know, pest control companies that have been built off of those relationships with realtors and chasing WDIs or inspections and you know, treatments. So it's not that it's necessarily, you know, a bad idea. It's just you got to kind of pick and choose where you're going to go, but you also have to insulate yourself, you know, through diversity of how you get your leads. How do you get those, you know, those revenue streams? Because if you're all in with a builder, you're all in with a realtor, and like you said, one bad thing happens or the market tanks on the housing side, next thing you know, you don't have an alternate stream come in. So the best thing is have multiple streams of you know, where your leads are coming in, multiple relationships, because that way you can really weather any financial storm, economically speaking, you know, as you move forward with your business.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're at American at this time. You're building out the residential side, correct, of that business. Where was American at when you first came in? Were they, because they're another large company as of right now. Were they very small at the time? Was their commercial division already built out and pretty sizable?
Yeah, commercial and government were doing great. Again, kind of similar to what Viking was for the New Jersey area, American was to the DC and Maryland markets. You know, very well respected. Jay Nixon, who was the president at the time when I got there, you know, former NPMA president. His son, Matt, was, you know, following in his shoes. We had Dr. Richard Kramer as our entomologist. We had Wayne White, a lot of well-respected names in the industry that were on it. So I had a great leadership team when they got there, but they were heavily focused on the commercial and the government piece because that was their had been their bread and butter, and they were really good at it. Still good at it to this day, but again, they've diversified now and have a large portfolio of residential to support that should anything happen to any other part of that work.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, so you go to American. This was what year that you started with them?
2004. And I think we were like 50, maybe 60 employees at that time.
Okay. So 2004 to when? How long did you stay with American? Was that through the Anticimex acquisition?
Yeah. So I was there in 2016 when Anticimex came along. And that was, you know, kind of new to me. I wasn't sure who Anticimex was. I had to Google them, probably like everybody else that hears for the first time. And then I learned a little more about Anticimex. And I was like, okay, this is pretty cool. Got a, you know, a private equity backed pest control company out of Sweden. So I kind of doubled down on, you know, my commitment to what I was going to do in my leadership role. And then fast forward a year later, Viking was acquired and I was asked to come up here and help out. That helping out led into me becoming the president of Viking. And that's where I remain today.
Okay. So you came over in 2017 to Viking, when they were first acquired. What did that role first look like? Was it figuring out what the business was and how it meshed into Anticimex? Or, you know, what did you anticipate coming there for?
Yeah, I really didn't know what I was walking into, to be honest, Adam. It's one of those things where you kind of like show up and see what they need help with. But what I realized is, like many of these companies that are, you know, purchased through M&A, they don't necessarily know what to expect or what the M&A world looks like, or, you know, what's going to be asked of them. So coming into that, it was really just kind of getting through, and, you know, you want to stabilize the business, you want to stabilize the personnel and make sure everybody's comfortable and in a good place moving forward. But then you also have to have a strategy, and what's your future strategy for the next 5 years. So really I came in, and a lot of the leadership was, you know, of retirement age, similar to Ed, because there's a lot of guys that he had probably hired, you know, 20, 30 years prior. So I started working to rebuild the team and kind of build out what that would look like for, you know, the next 5 years. We always had that 5-year plan. What's your 5-year plan? It's just a rolling 5-year plan. And part of that was building out a leadership team and looking at more M&A opportunities so that we could grow Viking into kind of a powerhouse in New Jersey.
Yeah, wonderful. So I want to stay here for a second, because it's something that I think is interesting to me and to a lot of people in the small to mid-range size, is what that acquisition process looks like. I've been on the being acquired side. However, as soon as we were acquired, I stayed on as a consultant, right? But I was remote, and I really was on a call with them maybe once a week to chat for 20 minutes about this or that. And so I didn't really see that process post-acquisition. I heard from some of my former employees about what it looked like. And Truly Nolan was our acquirer, and they were great, and they were awesome, and super helpful. And everything that I heard was good in post-acquisition. But I would imagine that there's a lot of fear and trepidation and concern about what the future will look like. So I know you were part of it, I guess, then from American being acquired. You were part of the Viking acquisition then. And then I know just from your and I's conversations that you've been part of many more acquisitions post that time. So what does that look like from an Anticimex perspective of how do you come in and calm those fears? And what does it look like from the acquirer side when you're coming in to buy a company like that?
Sure. It's an interesting question. And I've done, you know, more than a dozen transactions myself. So I think the interesting thing, the common denominator between all transactions, no matter what size they are, is there is that fear, there's that trepidation that people worry about what's going to happen to me. And the first thing I tell people is, guys, like, not only are we buying a business, we want the people that come with the business. Now, it's not just a book of business. It's about the people that service it. It's the technicians, it's the CSRs, it's the leadership, because ultimately you need all those things for that to go well and run smoothly. You know, there is no cavalry that's coming to, you know, run the services for that day or answer the phones. And I think when people understand that, they're like, oh, I'm actually a critical part of this. Then they kind of calm down. They're like, okay. And then, you know, they're coming back to work a week, 2 weeks, a month later. You're like, all right, the wheels aren't falling off the wagon. Everything's pretty cool. I actually like the people I'm working with. And Anticimex is just a name. At the end of the day, it's a name of a business. The people of Anticimex are people like myself, people that have sat in that seat, gone through that same journey. And I can sit there and I can talk to the acquired employees and say, guys, I was sitting here in 2016 having the same conversation with somebody else, you know, so I've been down this road. So to me, being able to sit there and talk about having that experience, and as we continue to grow and grow and grow, you look around at our leadership and you look around the room and you realize there's very few people that are original Vikings or original American Pest folks. Most of us are here because of acquisition. And when you realize we're all on the same team, a lot of the other stuff kind of goes away. It's the noise, it's the chatter. But that's kind of normal. I think that would be normal in any environment, probably in any industry. It's the fear of the unknown. It's the fear of the future. What's in store for the future? I want to know. But what I tell people is it's nothing but opportunity. So if you want to take this opportunity and make the best of it, it'll be the best thing ever. If you want to look at this thing as the worst thing that ever happened to you, then that's what it's going to be. So it really comes down to the individual saying, how do I process this? What does it mean? And giving us an opportunity.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I had a similar conversation because me as a small pest control business, I could only offer so many opportunities for my employees. I only had so many manager roles, and I only had so many area, you know, manager roles for somebody to grow into. But if somebody like Anticimex comes in and now you're part of this big network, there's so many more opportunities for you to grow and to develop and become, you know, a career role, as opposed to somebody who worked for me that could probably only ever be a technician and then have to move on to somebody else to advance their career.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Adam. And I've, you know, as I look around, I see, you know, almost every person in a different position, doing something different. And to me, that's part of the excitement of being the leader. You get to see people progress and take, they're getting married, they're having kids, but also they're growing within the organization. So it's not just, we're like one big family. You look and you want to celebrate their wins, and their wins may be personal, they may be professional, but either way, a win is a win. And sometimes we lose people. Sometimes somebody goes off to be a police officer, chase another career. I celebrate those too. Sometimes we're just a stepping stone in somebody's career path to something else. That's fine. But my goal is just to be the best employer I can be during the time that someone's with me. And if I can provide you a pathway where you can excel and you can be promoted and you can do other things, it's really cool. And sometimes people would say, hey, I just want to work in marketing. But you find out you have a technician that's actually went to school for marketing. The next thing you know, he's not a technician anymore. They're working in the marketing department. Or you find somebody that says, hey, I've got family that's up in Maine. Well, we've got a sister company, Modern, that's up in Maine. So they can go, they can put in for a transfer. Next thing you know, they're relocating back to be where their family is. So I see a lot of wins out of it. I really, there's very infrequently is there ever something negative that comes out of that.
Yeah. I think that one of the fears, at least from me, and I haven't worked for somebody in a long time other than myself. And so that fear is maybe just more current and present in my brain. But that fear of becoming a corporate entity, right? When it was a small office, there's 10, 15 people that work for the company, and then you get acquired and now there's hundreds or thousands of employees. Do you ever feel like there's a potential for them to feel like they're getting lost in the weeds and they're not part of a family anymore and now just part of some big company?
That potential always exists, but I think the one unique thing that's really cool about the Anticimex model, we run a decentralized model. So I run Viking in the New Jersey area. I've got a counterpart running American down in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area. I've got a counterpart running New York City, in New York State, in that area. But each one of us runs as our own platform. So each platform has its own culture, and that culture is what's going to really engage and drive the people. Ultimately, we drive that down to the branch level. So the branch is kind of like the little business unit within the business. So whatever the culture is of that branch, that's the culture that most people engage in at the technician level. They're going to say, hey, what's my team look like? Am I working with 20, 30, 40 people? But most of our branches are fairly small still, kind of like what the original family-owned business may have looked like. So they don't necessarily have that feel like, hey, I'm part of this big corporate environment, but they do get the benefit of it from, might be healthcare benefits and things that we can provide at a lower cost, that they're like, hey, I'm actually getting some wins out of this at the same time.
Yeah. That's great. I remember the day I was able to tell everyone they were all getting raises because we underpaid them. I paid them as much as we could, but when we were getting acquired, they're like, no, sorry, we start everyone above where your highest person is. So everyone is going to get a raise. And so that was a huge piece to be able to say, I'm putting this in someone else's hands and they're going to take care of you. They're going to continue to do the things and maybe do things better and have more resources than I could have ever tried to give you.
Yeah. And that's very, very frequently, that's the case that we walk into on day one. We walk in and we're able to offer better benefits or cost savings. We're able to offer 401k match. A lot of the things that larger corporations would normally do that smaller owners may not be able to afford to do, to your point.
Awesome. Well, I love talking about the acquisition side. So we may come back here, but really quick, I want to just get a picture of what Viking looks like right now. So how many employees? You talk about different departments, right? There's marketing, there's operations, there's sales, there's accounting, I'm sure HR, all these teams. And so what does Viking as a whole look like in this decentralized Anticimex model?
Yeah. So the exciting thing is that today we're over 400 people strong in our team. I've got a very diverse team of people with all sorts of skill sets, all walks of life, kind of scattered all over the area. We actually cover Eastern Pennsylvania. I keep saying New Jersey, but we cover Eastern PA, we cover Eastern Shore, Maryland, Delaware, and then all of New Jersey as well. So we've grown tremendously since I got here in 2017.
Awesome. So 400 total. What does that look like from a technician perspective? How many techs are out there on the streets every day?
Just over half of that is our technicians in the field.
Okay. Awesome. So 200 plus technicians out there performing services. I know that Anticimex is a large company, and so revenue a lot of times can't be divulged. But if we're doing the math, there's a fair amount of revenue. If we're looking at average route sizes for technicians, Viking is a large scale company.
Yeah, we've grown tremendously. We've nearly tripled our revenues since I got here in 2017. So yes, we thankfully, and as by design, we've grown into a fairly large organization.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on that. That's no small feat to do. And that's what I want to stay on for a minute here is what your role looks like now, because for a lot of us in these small to medium-sized businesses, you can't really picture what it looks like to be the president of Viking, for instance. You're so caught up in the day-to-day that I want to take a look, because I have the inkling that a lot of what you do is what we do and what other people have done on a day-to-day basis, just at maybe a bigger scale. And so I want to prove that thesis though, and get a feel for what your job description looks like. And so maybe just, if you can, run me through a traditional day in the life of Paul as president of Viking so that we can get a feel for that.
Yeah, sure. And I can probably tell you your thesis is probably true, because it really becomes about just keeping out of the weeds. But my day starts kind of the same way my day has always started. I get up, I look at my calendar, I see what appointments I have on there, I see if I have meetings, make sure I'm ready for whatever those events might be of the day. Then I go back to my emails, I start sifting through my emails, make sure to follow up on anything that might be higher urgency or important that needs to be dealt with immediately. And then I check in with my team. Probably the same thing that most business leaders are doing. You check in with your team, see how they're doing, make sure everything's going smoothly, make sure you know nothing's on fire. And then after that, I usually go back to, you know, it's kind of back to the old Outlook calendar and say, all right, what's the next thing? And you know, there's a lot of email communications in today's day and age. So nobody picks up the phone anymore. Everything's email, email, email. So yes, there are a lot of emails exchanged, but we also do a lot of Teams collaboration. So we use Microsoft Teams. I'm constantly talking to somebody on Teams throughout the day, getting that one-on-one experience. You know, it's video chat. It's pretty cool. We like to utilize technology, brings you a little closer to your people, even when geographically they may not be in the same building with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really no different, right? If I was, you know, I was based in El Paso, Texas, and I had a team in Austin and a team in Dallas, and it's no different. I can't be out there on the streets with them every day. Even in El Paso, I wasn't out there at homes performing services every day. I was managing leadership and I was structuring their routes and I was structuring bonuses and, you know, all the things that come down from leadership anyways. So yeah, okay. So we've proven a little bit of that thesis that we're really not as different as it seems. But what does your leadership team look like? Do you have, you know, a director of operations that handles all of your tech routing? Do you have, you know, how does it kind of break down and funnel from you?
Yeah. So I've got five VPs that report directly to me, a couple other support staff as well, but we're fairly flat organizationally. You know, I don't want there to be a ton of layers between me and the customer. So that allows me to continue to kind of put my fingerprint on the business and, you know, ensure quality and the delivery of service. But my VPs, they've got directors that report to them, and they've got branch managers that report to them. So there's really only another layer between them, and then the branch managers have all the technicians. You've got service managers. But again, it's a fairly flat organization, because in any large organization, if you build that up like a steep pyramid, you're pretty far removed from the customer. And the farther removed from the customer, the less in touch you are as the operator of that business.
Yeah. And that makes a huge difference into your growth. And obviously you've grown very quickly over the last period of time. And so you're seeing that and you're feeling that. How do you, and obviously I'm a data guy, right? And driven is all about performance metrics. And so that kind of fits, but how do you monitor your team as it stands right now? How do you tell that you're being successful? Is it just a report that your VPs put together that you look through and say, hey, the line's going up and to the right? Or are you more granular than that in understanding what's happening on a day-to-day level?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that's where a lot of the information comes in silos, because you've got your sales team looking at, you know, closing metrics, they got lead counts, you've got a customer service team looking at what our eNPS scores are. I've got my financial team obviously working on bringing the financials together. So you kind of got to go to a lot of different points to get the information you need. Certainly, you can try to hodgepodge that together, and you can, you know, you can build out some dashboards. So the question then becomes, like, how old is the data? Is this stale data? Am I looking at yesterday's numbers? Am I looking at last month's numbers? We all know that when you're looking at your financials, by that time the books are closed, it's, you know, it's done. That chapter is, you know, you can't go back and undo what February was. So I think by keeping as close a pulse as you can on all those KPIs, that really helps you monitor the health of the business. And that's, as leaders, you kind of always want to know, hey, what's, you know, what were my sales yesterday? What did we do yesterday? What's the average route value look like? You know, even things down to like how many people called out sick yesterday. You need to know those things. You need to know where you're at from a staffing perspective. Are we right where we need to be with staff? Are we ahead of the game? Do we have people in the pipeline to onboard? You lose control over one metric, and all of a sudden that can have a pretty significant impact on the business.
Yeah. And what your whole description just now just confirmed the rest of my thesis, right? Because all of those things that you're talking about are the important key things for a single owner operator or an operator that has 5 people or 50 people or 100 people or 800 people. The concept is the same across all of that, because those things that you can track and report on are the things that matter to a pest control company. And so your growth happens as you start to understand and see that those key metrics are being met every day. And if they're not, I'm sure you're having conversations with your VP, who's having conversations with their service managers, and it's going down the line to be able to improve that behavior.
Yeah. And what I've told my team, and I've told them many times over the years, is if you don't have the data and you don't have the numbers, it's like playing a sport without knowing what the score is. How do you know if you're winning? Ultimately, you always have to have that data. You got to have your numbers. You got to know your numbers, because otherwise it's a best guess. It's a feel good moment. Oh, I think things are going well. That's not a quantifiable number. You've got to know the numbers.
That's great. Love it. And it sounds like you have the tools in place to be able to do that. There's two questions that I want to continue on with. And one is kind of coming back to the acquisition side of things, because in the first, 6 years of my business, I always thought someday I want to sell. I didn't know when or how or, what I was going to do to be able to reach that goal. But I knew that eventually I wanted to sell the company. And so you mentioned over a dozen transactions that you've been involved in. What do you look for as an acquirer that, tells you it's a healthy business, tells you that it's something that you want to buy? And this may be some trade secret, so you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but that makes you want to buy at a higher valuation, right? What do you see that says this company is worth me stretching to give them the most that I can because they're so valuable to me?
Yeah, sure. That's not a problem. I don't mind sharing. I don't think it's a trade secret in the sense of, there's a lot of PE groups out there, and the math has to make sense at the end of the day for any company that's going to be acquired. So it's a bit of a cliche answer, but we're always looking for quality companies. But there are companies out there that are not what I would call high quality. But what does quality look like? Quality to me is a solid base of customers, probably on a recurring basis. You've got contracts on file. Ideally, you've got credit cards or a payment method on file. You're not chasing the money. You've got great employees. So, are they using things like Quality Pro? Are they actually vetting who they're hiring and saying into people's homes? That's important. I think the other piece of that is pricing. I know when we were working for a family-owned business, a lot of people are afraid to increase their prices. And it's, kind of sad when we look back. I look back at 20 years of doing this, and I'm like, the prices haven't moved that much from when I started 20 years ago. And why is that? Because prices on everything else have gone up. You look at a 20-year average on any other, commodity, and it's probably up significantly. But pest control, we're like, we're up $10 from where we were 20 years ago, right. Which is crazy. So ultimately, I don't think that's a trade secret, but it's high quality recurring base with payments on file. And again, reputation, the company has to have a quality reputation within their community. And that's reflected on social media. That's reflected through all the different places with reviews and Google reviews and Yelp and those things. If somebody hasn't taken care of their customers, you're going to be able to see that pretty quickly.
So all of those things are clearly important to the business. When you're first taking a look, though, do you have access to all of that? Or are you basing it off of annual revenue that they have on the books? Or is there like a benchmark and then you start digging in and looking at reputation? I'm trying to get a feel for what it looks like to sit in your chair. Like, are you Googling these companies and seeing how many reviews they have? Or is it more sophisticated than that? What does it look like to start?
Now, to start, usually you're just looking for actually a conversation. You've got to have a conversation with a key decision maker. Just like in sales, it's kind of the same process. You want to get to who has an ownership stake in this business. Is it one person? Is it a family? Is it multiple people? Because you got to start that conversation somewhere. And the most important thing here is, are they willing or interested in selling their business? Because if there's no interest, you really don't need to go any further. You don't even need to read the financials if somebody says, I'm not going to sell anytime in the next 10 years. Okay, well, then we can have that conversation when the time is right. But I'm happy to have those relationships and keep those going. You know, if that's a 5 or 10 year relationship, great. Call me 5 or 10 years. We'll have that conversation. But if you have the conversation and you get access to the financials at a high level, then you, at some point you're going to start digging into, all right, what is the recurring base here? What's the business mix? Is it commercial, residential? How do you take payments? Things of that nature. As we go through due diligence, I would start looking at things like, all right, what's their reputation look like? Then you start looking at the personnel, things like that. Some things from a timing perspective, you're just limited on what you can get access to. But you also got to be not afraid to walk away from a deal. I've walked away from them where I'm just like, this isn't a quality business. I'm not going to pay a premium for something that's not a quality business. And that's okay too.
Yeah. Is there a bottom benchmark as far as revenue goes that you won't look under for Anticimex's purposes?
I don't know that there's an absolute bottom benchmark because I've purchased some very small companies, you know, 1-2 man operations. I think the challenge becomes, you know, how much time do I have in a day, just like everybody else's challenge? And every acquisition, in theory, takes a similar amount of time to work through the process. You know, if that business is 500,000 or if that business is 5 million, you still have to go through a lot of the same processes. So that's the difficulty. And the other piece of it is the smaller your business, I would almost argue the more challenging it is for an acquirer to buy it. If you're, as the owner of this, you're the face of that business, then all of a sudden the customers are like, okay, well, now I don't see Adam anymore. Where'd Adam go? Well, Adam sold the business. Right. So the faster you can grow your business and have technicians out there that are the face of the business and technicians that go along with the deal, you're in a much better position as a seller. When you're the only face of that business, that's not ideal from an acquirer's viewpoint.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. And last question on acquisitions, and I'm not asking you to endorse any by any means, but are a lot of your transactions happening through brokers? Because I know there's a bunch of quality brokers in our industry that are working to help support and work in the M&A space. Is that something that happens a lot with Anticimex? And do you find that it's really valuable to a lot of small business owners?
Yeah, I think it's a very individually based decision as to whether you want to work with a broker or not work with a broker. I've seen brokers do a great job. I've seen brokers do not so great a job. I think they help the seller understand the market better and understand what they need to do as a business. And some of those brokers may even tell people like, hey, you're not ready to sell. You need to go work on these 5 or 10 things and let's come back to this in a year or two. So again, ultimately, it is very much an individual decision as to whether a seller wants to go with a broker, not go with a broker. I've seen deals go very successfully without a broker. I've also seen deals not go great with a broker. So I don't know that the broker is necessarily the key to a deal being great for both parties at the end of the day.
Okay. And as far as acquisitions go and Viking, where do you see Viking being in the next 5 to 10 years? Are you going to continue that, you know, triple growth over 5 years, 6 years, or do you think it'll slow and maintain a slider curve up? What are the goals that you have for Viking and for yourself in the organization?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I often wonder about that. You know, can we keep up the same pace at which we're going? I think the reality of it is obviously a lot of the large family-owned businesses have been bought up over the last 5-10 years. So with more players in the market, more PE groups coming to market than we've ever seen before, I think at some point there's going to be some larger consolidations. There's too many PE groups out there right now that have bought up a lot of other small companies. They're trying to bundle them together. At some point, those PE groups are going to make their exit. But I see Viking continuing to, you know, buy up more small businesses. I don't see that slowing down at any point in time because at the same time as we're talking, somebody else is out there building their business and they're going to go from 1 million to 2 million to 3 million. And they'll be in a position, you know, a few years down the road to sell their business.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. It sounds like there's a lot of growth ahead for you and for Viking and for the industry in general. Every time I talk to somebody, I'm more encouraged with where our industry is going and the direction and the goals that people have. I know we have legislative days coming up here shortly and to be able to see all the leaders of our industry coming together and helping to support that growth, I think is pretty special and pretty unique to a lot of industries that are out there. So my last question for you is something that we've kind of built as a tradition here. And it focuses on more of the emotional side of the business. And so as vulnerable as you're willing to get with us, the question is, what is, you know, one of your highest highs of your pest control experience And what is one of your lowest lows that you've had to deal with since coming into American and then Viking?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the highest high, we'll start with the positive. In 2022, Viking was the global platform of the year for all of AntiCMEX. So I think for me and my team, I mean, we put a lot of hard work into that. You know, from 2017 to that point, to be platform of the year was a big deal for us and just a huge win and celebration for the whole team. So that's got to be the highest high. Yeah, that's right up there with top life events in my mind.
That's great. Congrats.
Thank you. And the lowest low, I think when I left American, I worked with that team for almost 13 years at that point, and I came up to Viking, and I had to start rebuilding the team. You know, it was a new environment, new people. They didn't know me. I didn't know them. We had to, you know, establish that trust and that relationship. And then I had to kind of paint my vision of what the next 5 years was going to look like and get, you know, my new leadership team on board to say, hey, we're with you. We're going to do this to get to that point where we could be, you know, platform of the year. I think the redemption is when you achieve that, or you're up there and you're like, all right, you got that crystal trophy and you're like, we made it. We did this. So that was probably my lowest low. And only because you're just kind of, it's like walking into a new school on the first day, being the new kid. You don't know anybody. And you got to figure out, how do I, you know, get some few people to like me here and go with this. But it's, you know, it paid off. The hard work we put in, it's paid off. And I hesitate to even call it a lowest low, because I feel like if you don't, you know, you got to get to that point to get to a win.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an important mindset, is, you know, sometimes you have to go backwards to go forward, to reach the goals that we have. We have to lose sometimes, and by losing and by experiencing tough things, we build and we gain the traits that lead us to the point that we want to get to. And not that we're done by any means. I know from our conversations that you're not done by any means. You have a lot left that you want to do and left that you want to contribute and continue that growth. But it's good also to find those wins and hold on to them and value that as we achieve them.
I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know who to attribute the quote to, or if it is a quote, but I think as soon as you find yourself being comfortable, you probably need to figure out how to be uncomfortable again. And that's what drives that growth and that performance.
Love that. Love that. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us on this episode today. I know our listeners can find you on LinkedIn. They can find Viking online as well. And obviously you can find The Business Bug online and anywhere that you find your podcasts. So thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe and leave a review if you like what you've listened to. And we'll see you guys soon. Thanks.